So who in the room thinks that they are 100% equipped to detect compromise in their organization? Great, none of you are delusional. Cool. Because it is very, very true that no matter how much money you spend, how mature of an IT organization you are, that you are probably not monitoring the most important things. Who here is a domain admin? Of you domain admins, who gets alerts when an account gets locked out? You guys are being desensitized to critical issues. Did you know that? Because a real bad guy isn't going to lock out accounts nowadays. It's very easy to see what your lockout strategy is, and if it's 5 attempts, do 4, and then wait an hour, right? So if you are having your inbox constantly filled with unimportant data, it makes it very difficult to focus on what does matter, right? So we're going to talk a little bit today about what matters and how to log it, but more importantly, we're going to talk about how you can use tools you already have. I am not here to sell you anything. Yay me, right? Yeah. We're going to talk about using stuff you already have. And at the end of this, thanks to this guy in the front row, Russell Tompkins, I'm going to show you how to go home, run 2 commands, and be monitoring for the top 5 security things that happen during a compromise. That's pretty cool, right? So logging, it sounds really easy. You know, let's get those critical events. They're red colored. Let's monitor those ones. They're red, right? We'll collect the ones that are red, and then we'll alert people, and that will tell us when something's wrong. That doesn't work. No. I mean, logging is, in fact, the hardest, simplest thing, because there are so many tools out there that will do it. There are so many products out there that will help you. There's 1,001 ways that if you've got a couple $1,000,000, I'll be glad to help you, you know, configure something. But it's really not about what tool you use or what technology you're using. It's about knowing what's normal and what's abnormal. And that's the big problem, because in security nowadays, most people who are up on the stage talking to you about security are talking to you about something new and shiny and, you know, of the moment. So we might be talking about a product that is new and shiny and of the moment that you might go out and purchase, or we might be talking about an attack, something like DLL sideloading. And for the first question that I give away a Kinder Egg, who knows what DLL sideloading is? Oh my goodness, okay. DLL sideloading, you didn't know this is what you were coming into, did you? So DLL sideloading is actually the underlying mechanism of how something called invoke-mimikatz works. So who has heard of mimikatz? All right, mimikatz is a credential theft software. It's the new hotness as far as credential theft goes because it does a little bit more than the old ones did. But what DLL sideloading enables is to do something called invoke-mimikatz. So who's a PowerShell person? Who can guess what that invoke in the front means? It's a PowerShell script. So if we can do DLL sideloading, we can run a malicious executable entirely in memory and not leave any trace, and likely not be detected by an antivirus product. So that's very cool, but if I'm worried about DLL sideloading, more than one of you knew what mimikatz was, I'm sorry, nobody gets Kinder Egg. If I'm worried about DLL sideloading, but I haven't done something like stopping domain admins from logging into workstations, I'm probably focusing on the wrong thing. So that's what we want to talk about when we talk about monitoring today. Not just what to monitor, but why you're monitoring it. If you've ever imported a SCOM management pack and then had your phone's battery die because it just paged you all day long, you got a lot of alerts, but do you know why it was monitoring it? And that's what we want to do today. We want to talk about 5 critical alerts for you to monitor and why they matter. And the really, really super cool thing is, like I said, you'll be able to go home, run a 2-line script. There's a cord under that sting, and I just tripped. And you will be able to monitor for those 5 events. So I visit a lot of customers in my role, and I have observed 2 sets of monitoring strategies. Here's a Venn diagram of them. So either they are monitoring lots and lots of things with no context. They have absolutely everything coming into their monitoring system, every single event. But they have no idea what it means. So if we're looking at, you know, gigs and gigs and terabytes of data, how do you find the specific 1102 event? Do you know what you're looking for with a 1102? That's the real challenge, is they may have all of the data, but they can't interpret it, and they don't have context, because they don't know what their systems are supposed to be doing. If you don't have appropriate architectural service diagrams and an understanding of what the authentication patterns are for your websites, how do you know that a bunch of anonymous logons in a security log aren't normal? So it's really about understanding what the data is. And of course, there's the completely opposite side of the spectrum, which unfortunately I encounter a lot when I go out to do incident response, is they're not logging anything. We find that, yes, this Venn diagram does not meet in the middle. We have very few people who are doing it the right way. So hopefully we can help out a little bit with that. So my role at Microsoft is actually incident response. Raise your hand if you knew that Microsoft does incident response for our customers. Did you know that because of a blog post that came out today talking about it, all 10 of you that raised your hands? Cool, okay. So just a little brief segue. I do work in something called the Enterprise Cybersecurity Group, which is a newly formed unit inside of Microsoft, where we're gonna focus on, you know, keeping you safe as well as helping you if you are in trouble. So my job is usually not because somebody's monitoring has detected compromise, but most of the time because some government agency or someone like that has called them and said, hey, BT Dubs, you've been hacked. So that's why we want to try to get there a little bit sooner with the monitoring. So one of the big things we see is the companies don't have centralized logging, because centralized logging is really, really cost prohibitive for some of the smaller to medium-sized businesses. If we're talking about something that's going to cost you a couple million dollars to implement and charges you for each agent you put onto a workstation, there's a good chance you're not seeing any data from the workstations, right? Quick show of hands, how many of you are monitoring to your centralized logging, if you have it, workstation security logs? One, two. So two out of a room of about 50 people, I'd say, which is about the thing I see in the wild. If you have been listening to any of the cybersecurity talks this week at Ignite, where does the compromise usually start? The workstation, yes. So if we are not monitoring the workstation for security events, that means that the bad guy is gonna come in and have a long time to wander around. So if centralized logging is cost prohibitive, that means that people can't get that data from the workstations into their centralized logging. And that's something we're gonna fix today with what we're doing. That's the other thing, is not just the endpoints like the workstations, but the servers too. Frequently, people are only getting the logs off of their domain controllers. Authentication mechanisms like LAN Manager, AntiLM, Kerberos, they don't always have to hit the domain controller, especially if you're using an attack technique. It is 100% possible to do pass the hash on one workstation and put it on another workstation and never touch the domain controller. Same thing with pass the ticket. So if you are only looking at your domain controllers, there's a good chance that you are going to miss some important data. The other thing is we are spamming logs with extra data, with tons and tons of data. I personally like the IPsec filter driver because it gives me a ton of information. But if you have the IPsec filter driver enabled on a SQL server, there's going to be nothing else in your log in about 35 seconds. So if we are going to try to get more in-depth data, we have to have a strategy for getting the important targeted events off of those systems. And logging of key events, understanding what a key event is. I've been to places that have had several terabytes of centralized logging data, but they were missing group changes in Active Directory. Group changes like the domain admins group. So that meant that while we had a ton of data, we didn't understand what was important to log. And the the logs are rolling too quickly. We're not able to get what we need off of that box before it rolls. It's perfectly fine to have your log roll. We're not after you keeping a 7 gig event log on your workstations. It's okay to have the log roll if when something important does happen, it's been moved off the box to somewhere else. And another thing is that people in the logging world are usually the security admins, which means the IT admins don't own their own data. So if you've ever had the problem of going to your security team and saying, can you tell me what service account X was doing over the past week? And it takes you about 24 hours to get the report, and maybe they don't have the data. Wouldn't it be nice to be in control of your own destiny for that sort of report? That would be cool, right? Because this isn't just a security thing, it's an operational thing too. Because let's say that you're having, you know, and you've taken an account and you put it into the protected users group in Active Directory. What's the protected users group? Who knows that? Are you guys just not answering questions because you don't want to? All right, so, Jess Dodson, what's the protected users group? It's a group that is an Active Directory, and it came out in 2012 R2, and it has actually been backported through a KB article called 287.1997, where you can use it in 2008 R2 and Windows 7. But if you put someone in the protected users group, they can no longer use NTLM anywhere. So NTLM bad, Kerberos good, putting somebody in there means they can't have NTLM any longer. So if you've done something, like implemented this amazing protected users group that all these crazy Microsoft people are talking about, and suddenly you find out that service account X isn't working, or domain user Y that you put in that group isn't using, being able to create a really, really targeted event log looking for just that user without having to go to the security team, who probably have enough to do, and ask them to make you this report would be really, really great as an IT admin, right? Everybody wants this, right? Everybody wants this. How much would you pay for this solution? I have a special deal for you today. This is free 99. That is what you have, because you actually own all of the technology to do this today. So of the 30% of you who answered my poll and knew what I was going to be talking about today, what is this magical free technology we're going to use? Windows Event Forwarding. Yes, and it is a role that is inside of Windows. It's a feature inside of Windows. And it has been around since 2003, I think, yeah. So it is something that you already own. All you need is a server. Or if you're really, really not able to get a server, today we're going to set up Windows Event Forwarding on a Windows 7 workstation. So if you have any barrier at all to centralized logging in your organization, maybe you're an educational organization and you've got limited budgets, or you're relatively small, or maybe your boss just isn't into it, this is something that you can set up right now and start to get important data. Sound good? Okay, all right. So, but really, the reason I wanted to do this talk today, this really is a public service announcement type of thing, because the one type of incident response tool that I wish I had that I don't is this one. Those are time machines, right? You need to set up the monitoring before you get attacked. And that's the really important thing, is the average time an attacker is on the network. Someone must have heard that today. 36 months. It's about 200 days, yeah. So I can't throw, so the people getting chocolate are getting that. But it's about 200 days that an attacker is on the network. So if you don't have the appropriate logging, and it's not going to a centralized place, after 200 days, when you do call an incident response team and the lovely forensic investigator shows up, she's not going to have anything to look at. It's going to be a really, really dead end. So getting in there now, getting at least some of the key data going, is really, really important. Because hopefully you are not yet compromised, but baby compromises happen every single day. All of the same attack vectors that are used for the targeted attacks are the same type of vulnerabilities that come in and give you things like CryptoLocker ransomware. You've had a case of ransomware on your network. There's no need to ask. You definitely have. So if you got ransomware, I'm going to give you a 98% chance that it came in through out-of-date Flash or Java, which is also what the bad guys like to use to put targeted malware on your systems. So baby compromises happen every day, and if you're not detecting things like application crashes of Flash on your workstation, there's a good chance you're missing initial attack vectors of real bad guys, as well as better insight into why you're getting really, really annoying stupid stuff like ransomware. So we're gonna do this with the power of Windows event forwarding, and it is gonna be really, really easy. So who knows what the NSA is? Okay, you're right. The NSA is a government agency that we have in my country that exists to write fabulous white papers. That's what they do. So this is spotting the adversary with Windows Event Forwarding. Go and download the white paper. We are going to cover a lot of what's in it today, but this is a fabulous white paper that will walk you through how to do Windows Event Forwarding. And I don't think a lot of people have seen it. So this is what the NSA exists for, honest. So benefits of Windows Event Forwarding. It's built in, like I said. We've got those amazing products. We've got Advanced Threat Analytics. We've got System Center. We've got all of that going on. But this is something that you don't have to write a purchase order. You don't have to write a project plan. You can already start using it today because we don't have those time machines. I want you to start getting monitoring today. And it can tie in if you do have something like a SIM or you do have centralized logging. How many of you have a GPO in your environment? Okay, good, good, good. Okay, you are listening, good. because that's how we're gonna configure Windows Event Forwarding, with a group policy. That's pretty easy, right? Yeah, okay, cool. We don't have to go around installing a client on everything. When we do set this up, it's gonna use Windows Remote Management for the communication. A lot of times we look at products that are using insecure protocols that don't make sure that they're not being man-in-the-middled. They use something called UDP as a protocol. I'd tell you a joke about UDP, but you probably wouldn't get it. Okay, somebody got it, because UDP is a connectionless protocol. so this is gonna use a TCP protocol that uses Kerberos-based authentication between the two endpoints. We're gonna verify who you're talking to, and we're gonna do it over an encrypted channel. So we know our events aren't being tampered with, and we know they're hitting the right person. Now there's some troubleshooting caveats that come out from the Kerberos thing, because if you've got service principal name issues in your environment, you can't get a Kerberos ticket to that system. So you're not gonna be able to do it. But we'll learn how to troubleshoot that. So Windows Event Forwarding is not meant to be collect all the stuff. That's not what this is meant to be. This is meant to be targeted to very specific events. That's why I focused on those five events that we're gonna look at today. Because we want you to just be looking at important data for certain subsets of machines. And it's using those native event log formats, that XML format. So if you know how to open up Event Viewer, you will be able to read these logs. But it means that it's extensible too. You can use PowerShell, you could create a web UI, you could do whatever you want because these are just XML. And another great thing about that is they're just XML. So you don't have to go buy a new SAN in order to store some data. Because if you are just collecting the bad events in your network, there's a good chance you're not gonna fill up that 20 gig drive with an XML file. So that's pretty cool too, because a lot of times the barrier to entry of centralized logging is so much storage space. And we're gonna do the logs in what's called push mode. When I walk you through how to do it today, this is the way that I would like you to do it, because this is gonna be something that doesn't require you to install an agent on anything. It doesn't require you to give wide domain permissions. We are not going to add an account to the domain admins in order to be able to read logs off of domain controllers. That's a bad idea. So we're gonna be able to collect events off of domain controllers without increasing our attack surface. And as I mentioned before, you're gonna control your own logging destiny. You want a new event ID? Good, good, go make one, have fun, you know? All right, so, and now we are going to time travel to 1997. Are you ready? Because everything in this animation is going to document the infrastructure of WEF. So first things first, we have some computers. So these are the things that we want to get the events off of. We've also got a domain with a domain controller. At the domain controller, we create a group policy. That group policy is going to say, hey, computers, BT dubs, we've got this Windows event forwarding server over there, and we'd like you to check in with it. So we apply that group policy to the computers, and they now know about a Windows event forwarding server. That Windows event forwarding server, they now reach out to an HTTP interface, and they say, hi, I heard that you're a Windows event forwarding server. And the Windows event forwarding server says, yes, I love you guys, your computers. Please send me these events and only these events. And the computers say, that's such a great idea. I totally didn't want to send you my entire event log. And so then it happily sends off just the events that happen that meet that subscription. So it's a very targeted subscription-based logging. We aren't collecting every single thing and forcing you to wade through what it is. We're collecting known bad behaviors. So we do need to have a server, which can be a Windows 7 system. We do need to make a GPO. And we do, if we're going to monitor for the security log, we do need to grant the local network service on the machine the rights to read the security log. Now, if you've heard of the word lateral movement, who's heard of lateral movement? Okay, all right. So lateral movement is where a bad guy gets into your network, steals a credential, and starts to use that to access other systems. If we are using the local network service account that is individual to each machine, we are only going to let this machine read this machine's logs. So we are not creating a wide domain privilege in order to grant these sort of things. So we do have to add an additional permission, but it is one permission on one log local to that machine, which makes it a lot better than a lot of the other ways you could do this. And we do need to have the Windows Remote Management Service started on clients. It is not started by default on Windows 7. It's a very important thing to bring up that we are simply starting the service on the Windows 7 clients. We are not configuring it. If we just start the service, it doesn't create a listener. Because if you create a listener in Windows Remote Management in order to do something like PowerShell remoting, you're now listening on TCP port 5985, which is the one that all of those PowerShell-based attacks and all of that remote access would use. So it would be really, really bad if I asked you to increase your attack surface on every single one of your Windows 7 machines. And that is not what you are doing. You are simply starting that service. On the machine that serves as the collector, we will need to configure a listener. So it's imperative that you have the firewall on that one. You know where the collections are coming in from, and you're managing that. Because 5985 is a very, very attractive port to attackers, PowerShell remoting. So if we think about PowerShell remoting, PowerShell is very attractive not just because it's new. It's attractive because it doesn't have logging. In the version of PowerShell that is default on Windows 7 in 2002, PowerShell 2.0, there's no logging for who did what or what scripts were executed. So in most environments, in most Microsoft environments, I could run that invoke mimikatz command. I could run something called ninjacopy, and your forensic investigator would never know. They could take an educated guess, but there's a lot of ways to do that. So enter PS session, if that was available on those systems, is very attractive. So if you aren't limiting where 5985 can come from, if you're not thinking of that port as a high-value management port, wrap your head around that, because that's going to be a new trend. And we have a lot of different talks where we talk about that, so there'll be links, I think, available to this. So we need to think, when we do implement a security solution in our environment, we need to threat model it. If we're bringing in logging, if we're bringing in centralized management of some kind, you need to threat model it. You need to think, how would I attack this? Because I want to know how you would attack it. I don't want to know how a hacker would attack it. If an SCCM guy threat models SCCM, he's going to come up with some cleverer ways to do it. I recently met a SQL guy who can launch mimikatz as a stored procedure inside of SQL. I would have never thought of that, right? So this is one of those things. I know we're on a tangent here, but Windows Remote Management ties into all of that. Centralized logging is great. Centralized management is great. But think about your actions, because if you just started the Windows Remote Management Service and you didn't know whether or not it was listening, you could have created something worse there. So you're safe here. We're just starting the service. It's not listening. But we do need to think about what we do when we follow guides and how we implement those sort of things. So that's it for PowerPoint. We are now going to go and configure Windows Event Forwarding to monitor those things. Does that sound okay? All right. I have another Kinder Egg here. So I'm trying to think of a thing to ask you guys about monitoring. So I did ask a question on Twitter of the people who did know what Windows Event Forwarding was. What step do I need to do in order to be able to read event logs off of domain controllers? I'll give you a hint. I just said it in this session. We have to grant the network service access to read. Can't see who did it, but here you go. So yeah, that's absolutely what we need to do. So that is a key thing to know there. Oops, wrong thing. Okay. All right. It does take a second to load, I've been told, so. How many of you are doing centralized logging in your environments right now? So less than half of the audience. So is the reason you don't have centralized logging a technical concern, a budgetary concern? What's the holdback for it there? Yeah, so the question was, or the statement was, you know, who would be reviewing the logs is a big holdup to that. And that's one of the things that we do need to talk about when we come up with these monitoring strategies, because who is important to know about an event? So what is the event and who needs to know? Because you need to know not just who the technical person would be, but what the response team would be. Because if we get an event log that the security event log was cleared on a domain controller, so the AD team should probably know about that. But if you have an incident response team or a security team, they should probably know about that too, because that's potentially really, really bad. But the other problem is if you think about how most centralized logging solutions work, you have that 7 terabytes of data, and it's a constant scrolling stream of events, right? That's why we want to start small. We want to start with really, really 100% known to be bad events so that we can send those to the key type of people. So I would say that most of the events we'll look at today, it would go to the AD team, and it would go to your security incident response team. Like these are either real bad things happening or an admin who hasn't fully embraced appropriate administration strategies. We'll say it that way, right? So anyone else who isn't doing centralized logging, what's holding you back, do you think? Budget? Yeah. So free 99 would be a good price for you here, I think, right? So because what I want you to do is I want you to take this and I want you to start doing it in your environments, because it is really important. So first things first, we are going to go to what I have dubbed the Windows Event Collector. What is? Yeah, it is paused. Thank you, guy in the audience. All right, cool. So this is our log collector, which happens to be a Windows 7 workstation. I don't really want you to use a Windows 7 workstation in production if you don't have to, but there can be licensing reasons or whatever that might be holding you back from that. So ideally, this would be something like a Server 2012 R2 box. And the steps would change a little bit for configuring that. But the first thing we're going to need to do is we're going to need to configure Windows Remote Management to be listening on this box. So on this one, it does need to be listening. So I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to run a command prompt as administrator. And I'm going to run winrm space qc. So I know this is blindingly difficult, isn't it? So once I run that, it's going to ask me a couple questions. So the first one is that serious business question. It's going to ask me, do you actually want to create a listener on this box? Do you want to be listening on an HTTP type interface on 5985? So for this one, yes, the answer is yes, I would like to do that. All right, so there it is. The other thing it would ask you with the Windows firewall configured, it would ask you, do you want to poke a hole in the Windows firewall? So that would be the other question you ask you. So the Windows firewall is actually an interesting down-level component of Windows RM. If you have disabled the Windows firewall service, you cannot use Windows Event Forwarding. It won't work because that's an integral part of the operating system. So I'm a huge Windows Firewall fan, nerd, evangelist, call it what you want, come up afterwards and talk about it. I'll teach you how to build identity-based firewall rules. But the key component is you need that service started. You need to have that started in order to do a lot of things in the operating system, and Windows Event Forwarding is one of those. All right, so we have Windows Remote Management running. That's cool. So the next thing we're gonna do is we're gonna go ahead and bring up Computer Management or Event Viewer. Because that thing that you look at every time you troubleshoot something is actually where this magical centralized logging lives. So if we go into Event Viewer, and we go inside of subscriptions here, we are gonna be asked another question. I know. So the question we're asking is to work with subscriptions, you have to start the Windows Event Collector service. So this is gonna turn it to be an automatic always on type of service. And you do need that in order to do this. I did warn you guys this wasn't rocket surgery, right? This is easy. I see some people leaving. So for the recording, I'm going to shame those people and point out they left. No, just kidding. Another thing is this is all this stuff is documented, so don't feel the need to pause and take pictures, and feel free to ask questions. But we do need to have that service started, and we do need to have it running. So let's go ahead and click yes on that one there. Okay, we're done. No, really, that's it. You have configured Windows Remote Management on that, and you've configured the collector server. So now we need to do, if you remember the PowerPoint animation, we need to go tell the computers about this system. So we need to go create a group policy. And like a cooking show, I've already created this group policy. I apologize for the feedback. I don't know what that was. Okay. So we need to go and we need to create a group policy to do this. So we're going to go and we're going to edit the one that I've already created. All right, so the place that we need to do this is we need to go under Computer Configuration, Policies, Administrative Templates, Windows Components. And under here, we're gonna have event forwarding. Did you even know that was there? We hide it really well, don't we? There's a ton of stuff in there. So configure target subscription manager. That's the one we want. That's how we tell it about that web service to go check into. So we just need to enable that, and then we need to add the subscription manager in there. Now, the subscription manager, this is kind of a little bit of a weird thing to look at because it's a weird URL. Because you actually are going to give it, it's got the format actually over here, so if you don't have a guide, you can go over here and look at it. We need to give it the server to go to, which in my domain is Bob. We need to give it the port to talk to, which is 5985. We need to tell it it's WSMan, Windows Remote Management. That's when we need to go in and do it. And we give it a subscription manager, and then that interface, and at the end there, refresh equals 60. So refresh equals 60 is something that my colleagues and I like to put in there when we're testing Windows event forwarding, because that means every 60 seconds, the event log service of the client is going to check into this web service and find out if you've created any new subscriptions. That's independent of the group policy refresh cycle. So the refresh we put in that URL is how often do I check into the web service to find out if a new subscription has been created for me. So that's what that is there. Should you do 60 seconds in production is what the question was. Your mileage may vary. I do have a couple customers who actually have the refresh equals 60 in production, but for the most part, no. I wouldn't recommend that you need the every 60 seconds in production. So maybe, you know, you don't even, I think if you don't put it in there, it's every 15 minutes. So if you don't put it in, it'll be every 15 minutes or so. But when you're testing, this is really nice because it's very difficult to go out there and force it type of thing. So yeah, this is a testing component that we have there. Okay. So the next thing that we need to do, remember that network service component. We need to grant the network service the rights to read the security event log. So if I go over here to the workstation, I need to find out who actually has rights to view that security event log, because I need to not ruin who already has access when I grant the network service access. So there's a really easy way to do that from the command line. That is kind of strange, yeah. I do see that, thank you. I don't know, so this is live. For those of you on the recording, maybe we'll edit it. No, just kidding. let's see if I can get it started again. I am out of disk space. Okay. Ask me questions. Ask me questions while I fix that. How did I run out of disk space without knowing? That's a great question. Yeah, actually, the reason I ran out of disk space without knowing is because I actually cloned a disk there, and that was all my fault. So, that is a great question. So forwarding events to Windows event forwarding from non-domain joined or systems that are in another domain. What we're talking about using right now is we're talking about using it being Kerberos-based, but you can absolutely create certificate-based Windows event forwarding subscriptions. So if you've got a PKI infrastructure in your place, which hopefully you do, you can create certificates to actually get events from non-domain joined systems. Getting it from non-Windows-based systems is a lot harder. But you can absolutely do it from non-domain based. And if you're actually in a different domain, you don't have to create a trust. You can possibly create a realm trust and still create a Kerberos ticket into that domain. But certificate based is usually the way we recommend doing that. Great question. Okay, so the question is if you have a Windows remote management interface exposed, so if you do have, you know, it configured and you have that listener going on there, you would want to make sure that you do secure it because it is a command prompt, essentially. So what do you make it available to is an important question. But if you think about what your collector would be receiving from, you're receiving from all of the endpoints in your environment to that port. So it's a question of which executables and which content is allowed to be sent, because it's Windows Remote Management 5985, right? So what you could do is you could create inside of the Windows firewall certain IPsec rules that will actually give you ability to make sure that it's only a certain set of computers talking to it. But it is absolutely a very, very public port. And actually, if you do read that NSA white paper, they talk about locking down the Windows Remote Management interface so that you can actually find out what's going to actually reach into it and stop it from just being a command prompt on the internet. So what you do need to think about it, right? Because it can just be a command prompt. But it is a really difficult place to be, because you do have to be able to listen to that TCP port from everything in your environment. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, sir. You do not need to take notes. The question was, do I need to take notes? So all of this you'll be able to get later. You'll be able to get the recording, and there's actually going to be a couple blog posts that you'll get to it as well.
Second question is, as we move into mobile devices, is functionality involved with mobile devices?
So the question is, does Windows event forwarding work with mobile devices? If the mobile devices are Windows-based and they're Windows 10-based, yes, it does. Unfortunately, no, it does work on the current Windows phone. And it does work on the Surface. So yes, you would be able to configure that as long as they're domain joined. Yeah. They would have to be domain joined or managed by Intune, because you would have to be able to push settings and push a certificate to it. Yes, sir.
Where it's not practical to push that traffic across the WAN, can you have bridgeheads where they, mm-hmm. the, the, the central
I'm going to summarize it in a different way. So the question is about scalability, load balancing, and the architecture of where to put servers. Because if you do have a smaller site that's got something like a dial-up connection to it, even the tiny, tiny traffic that this creates, because this is nothing massive. These are just single events that only happen occasionally. Because hopefully nobody is clearing the security event log on your domain controllers on a daily basis, right? But you can actually configure with the group policies. So the group policies, you could link them at specific OU levels to say go to just this server, or you could create the subscriptions targeted to just certain groups of computers, because the subscriptions are actually based on groups of computer objects. So the subscription would tell it which server to go to, so you could create a bridgehead and then collect off of that one. So if you had something like a small site with a dial-up and you were able to bring up a smaller system there, link the group policy at the very tiny site office that says send all the events to this one, and then in a digest basis or maybe with something like SCOM, collect the events off of the bridgehead server, absolutely. Now, load balancing is the other kind of built-in question to that, because load balancing of this is Windows remote management traffic, and that's going to mean that you have to be able to do a Kerberos principal authentication. So you can't actually stick an F5 in front of it, or an A10, or a load balancer of that kind. That's unfortunate. So the way that we actually load balance it is you put multiple systems that all collect into it. That's actually the way that we would load balance this. So it's not perfect, but it is free, right? So to answer your question about traffic? Okay. Yes, sir.
Can you change the default send and receive ports?
The question was, can you change the default send and receive ports? You can, but it's a pain in the tuchus. So the reasons that you would want to use it is because it is default Windows remote manager traffic. What problem are you trying to solve by changing the ports? If I change a website from listening on port 80 to listening on port 9090, does that make it not HTTP traffic? It doesn't. So yes, it would stop a lot of things that are doing automatic port scanning of port 80. But the way that I would be attacking the traffic there, I would be able to usually attack it. We don't usually find that changing the port is very effective in this type of an attack vector, because if you type enter PS session, if you have somehow done the difficult duty of changing that port, which is really, really hard, enter PS session, computer name is still gonna work. It doesn't ask you for a port to it, so it's not like you're telnetting to it. So the bad guy attacks, the sophisticated bad guy attacks, they're just using the built-in stuff in your operating system, so unless it changes the behavior of that, it's not gonna change it, unfortunately. And thank you, Russell, for fixing my VMs. So, okay. Any more questions? That was great. Keep it coming. This is exciting. This is an interactive session. This is not terribly difficult stuff. Okay. Okay, so over on the workstation, I need to figure out who had access to the security event log. So running my command prompt as administrator, there's a command that you can actually use to find out who has access to a particular security event log, or event log in general. So it's WEC, UTIL, and they're gonna do GL, space security. And that's gonna tell you who has access to the security event log on that system. And thank you. And this is why you shouldn't use tiny little VMs in public. I'm so sorry. There you go. All right. So this stuff that comes out of there, these are who has access to that particular event log. So on the screen there, you can see that we have which log we looked at. So we're looking at the security log. It's enabled. And this channel access line there, the one that starts with the incredibly strange stuff that's called OBAGSID. So you're never going to forget OBAGSID. So OBAGSID is the line you want, because starting from that O all the way to the end with that parentheses there is who has access to this log. So this thing at the end there is got an NS on the end of it, because I've already appended network service to this. So how did I do that magic is the question. So what we want to do in order to give the tattooed permission there, take that line. We want to go ahead and we want to copy out from the O all the way to the last parentheses of what's there, because that's who has access to it currently. And then if we go back to our group policy, and we go to the event log service portion of our administrative templates, you'll actually see that the security log has its own area there for giving it different settings or how big it is or whatever. But the one thing is configure log access. You can define via group policy who has access to a particular log on a machine. Now, this is the security log in particular that we have to do this for. Yes, sir? Does it append it or modify it is the question. If you don't do it the way that I mentioned, where you copy the whole line, then you put a line on there, it will overwrite. This will be the authoritative setting of what you put in there. So if you think you've got disparate settings throughout your environment, you could have a problem there. Is that what the driver was? You could create a desired configuration management baseline inside of SCCM to audit who has it there. That might be a thing that you could do there. Or, you know, obviously you could run the WVT util script with the GL space security and find out. But the challenges of having lots and lots of tattooed permissions of security that might be different through the environment, that would give me more pause to concern about other things that might happen in the environment too. So it might be something you'd want to make as part of a bigger security audit, what local accounts are out there and things like that. But yeah, this does replace what's in that line. So what do we want to replace that line with? We want to replace it with that OBAG SID line. And in order to give the network service rights, at the very end there, we're going to append this little part. That little part is actually the local network service account. So that's all you do. You paste in what's there, you abbreviate that, you put it into a GPO, apply that, and boom, you are checking in to a Windows event forwarding server that has access to read your security logs. You only need to do it for the security log. It can already read application. I know, this is really hard. I can't imagine. It just, this is such a difficult thing to get centralized logging in your environments. I know, okay. All right, so now that we've got it and it's going to be checking in there, we can now create those targeted subscriptions. What are we particularly looking for here? And that's where we want to know, what do we want to monitor? What's important to look for in an environment so that we're not just collecting everything off of there? So some key things that I want my customers to be monitoring for that they usually aren't: security logs being cleared. I have been to many an incident response where the bad guy knows darn well that the customer is not monitoring when the security event log gets cleared. They come in, they do their business, they do what they want, they clear the security log, and they move on, right? So if somebody clears a security log, we should definitely be paying attention to that. That's something that is not a good thing. Local group changes or high-value domain group changes. So local group changes, how many of you know when the local administrator's group on your servers changes? Less than 5% of the audience, I would say. How many of you know when the local administrator group changes on your workstations? One guy. Kinder egg for him. So yeah, that's a key indicator of compromise right there. Because if I have done some sort of escalation of privilege in my environment, if I have taken advantage of physical access to a computer, because if you are not doing BitLocker on your workstations, did you know that that's a credential hygiene risk? Somebody's nodding. Okay. BitLocker isn't just for DLP, it's not just for data loss prevention. If you are not doing full disk encryption, I can boot off of a disk, grab your local administrator passwords, and Bob's your uncle, I have access to your entire network, right? So think about physical security as actually credential hygiene risk in some places. So if you aren't monitoring that I have grabbed your local administrator password, which until today when you found out about LAPS, the local administrator password solution, was probably matching in your environment, that means that I could go about and I could create built-in back doors on your systems. We're seeing this as a very popular technique because it's not malware, it's not something that, you know, can be detected, it's just an account named Bob sitting on a SQL server in the local administrators group. Is that supposed to be there? I don't know, right? So these are great backdoors because you don't need to re-compromise an entire environment to get back to the data you want. You just compromise one workstation with a piece of commodity malware, and you're right back in business in an environment. So local group changes are really important to monitor and really easy to monitor. So how many of you monitor when the domain admin's group changes in your environment? About half the audience, good, okay. How many of you monitor when the print operator's group changes in your environment? Nobody, one guy, okay. So the print operator's group is what we call a domain admin equivalent group in many organizations. And I will show you why. So knowing what your high-value domain groups is actually really important because it's not just the domain admins. It's not just the enterprise admins. If you have a group of help desk people that have administrative access to all of your systems, you might want to know when that one changes too, right? So high-value groups in your domain is not one size fits all. The event we're going to monitor today will be three of the high-value ones. But do a real assessment. What is a high-value group in your domain? The creation of local accounts is also something to keep an eye on. Because if I can do that attack where I've already gotten access to one thing or another, and I create a local account, that's that built-in backdoor right there. A local account is kind of invisible, especially if you're only logging your DCs to your centralized logging. That local account doing stuff, you're never gonna see it. It's never gonna hit the domain controller. It's never gonna hit your centralized logging, right? So kind of a cool thing. So local accounts being created is something we wanna watch for. We also wanna kinda watch for password changes to local accounts, things that might not be happening. If you have lapse in the environment, it should be changing the password, so we might need a little bit of massaging through something like your other centralized management in order to filter out the noise there, but it's entirely possible to do. Lateral account movement. This is actually something you can monitor for. It helps out a lot if you've already got the protective controls in your environment because they can serve as your detective controls. If you've done the appropriate things like preventing domain admins from RDPing to workstations or accessing that computer over the network, that means you're gonna see an access denied when something bad happens. So that one's really easy to monitor for. But you can actually create using something called special logon, which is an attribute you can configure for which groups you're looking at, you can get a special event ID that says, hey, people in the group named people who shouldn't log into workstations logged into this workstation. That's pretty cut and dry, right? That's a really cool feature, and I don't think enough people know about it or talk about it because it is something that you can configure. You can get a specialized event ID targeted to just a specific group that says that type of person attempted to log into this system. So you can quite easily create a group of service accounts, domain admins, people that shouldn't be logging into stuff, grab the SID of that, put it into the attribute I'll show you in the group policy, and now you have an event ID that indicates something bad is happening. That's targeted event monitoring. That's not looking at a ton of stuff. That's something really, really specific. Who knew about that attribute? Who knew about special logon? Cool, I helped today, except for the two Microsoft people in the front. Okay, application crashes. So if you attend my session tomorrow, you'll see a lovely slide about why application crashes matter. But application crashes are how malware gets onto systems. Unless it's user interactable malware, they install it or something like that, what happens is they're browsing to a legitimate website, a vulnerability in Flash causes the application to crash, that allows them to do an elevation of privilege to something like the win32k.sys driver, boom, their system. So application crash can directly be related to malware. This can be a lot of false positives, but it can be some good insight to collect, know about, and then that way if you do have something like a ransomware outbreak in your environment, you can trace it back and say, ah, Flash crashed 1 hour before it happened on this system. I wonder what version of Flash they have. Oh, it's out of date. There you go. You are now a forensic investigator in malware analysis. Yeah, right now, okay. All right, service installation. So who knows when a service gets installed on their domain controllers at 3 a.m? Would you have an event that tells you about that? Okay, one person nodded, okay. So why does this matter? It's kind of a twofold thing, because malware's persistence mechanism a lot of times is a service. So I have done something bad. I want to stay around on your system. I want to hang out there and do more bad things. I'm going to install a service. I might even name it something clever, like SVC host. Because then you're going to be like, oh, I know what that is. That's cool. I'm good with that, right? So service installation on a domain controller especially, it should be something that never, ever, ever, ever happens, right? We shouldn't be going around installing lots and lots of applications that run as a service on our domain controllers. So it should be an anomaly that you should be able to detect, which leads me back to something I said earlier in the session. There's a very popular hacking tool, or tool that's used by hackers, called PSExec. Thank you for laughing. So PSExec is a Microsoft product. It served a very important need in the old days because it allowed you to get a command prompt on a remote system. We didn't always have enter PS session, right? So not throwing PSExec under the bus here. But PSExec is really, really popular with bad guys. A lot of antivirus products actually identify it as malicious. But think about what PSExec does. PSExec connects to your system on RPC and file sharing ports and installs a service. That's exactly how bad guy malware and lateral movement happens. So one, we've got a known bad guy tool. Two, we've got known potentially malicious behavior of a service dropping. So if we're not monitoring for that type of thing, we could be missing a lot of stuff. And monitoring for new service creation on domain controllers is blindingly simple. So hopefully this is something you can take home and, you know, never see that event. But that does lead to the question of, what if I do use PSExec in my environment? Because there's always a couple people that still use PSExec. You would see alerts when you use PSExec, but because it's such a popular bad guy tool, I'd say move away from using PSExec for a little bit, switch to enter PS session, which is what we want you to do, and find out if anyone else is using PSExec in your environment. So service installation is what we want to be looking for there. Okay, so now let's configure some of those monitors I talked about, because we've seen how easy it is to set up the infrastructure. So let's see how painful it would be to set up a monitor. Okay, so we're going to go right back to the event viewer because that's where everything lives that we need to do here. So event viewer, and we're going to go into subscriptions because those subscriptions are what sit on that web service for those computers to collect to find out which targeted events it wants to look for. So we're going to go ahead and we're going to create a subscription. So we're going to have to give it a name. So what's the first thing that we should monitor? I think we'll do clearing of security event logs. That one's a pretty cut and dry one. That's a really, really bad one. And it also has a nice, well-known event ID. So 1102. And that's the one I memorized, so that's what we're going to do now. So let's give it a name. We'll do it log cleared. And then destination log. So this is where the event goes on this collector server. I'm going to recommend that you always pick forwarded events. It is possible to create a custom log and change it there, but it leads to some instability in the service. So let's just embrace forwarded events and let's roll with it, right? So subscription type. This is where we actually have to make a very important decision that's actually a very important security decision because we have collector initiated and we have source computer initiated. So push and pull, right? Push is the one we want, pull is the one we don't want. Collector initiated would mean that this computer object, right, this Windows event collector, has to have rights on those systems, stick its grubby little fingers in there, and pull out events. I don't like that one. That's not the one we want. So we want to do source computer initiated. That means that the computers are going to send me their events. They're allowed to send me their events, but I don't have to grant administrative access or anything like that. So source computer initiated, this is where we actually select which computers do it. So this is that targeting of it. There's a couple different ways that you can be more granular in how you assign the events. You could do an OU structure where you assign different collectors potentially. You can create groups of computer objects. But for the ones we're talking about today, these are pretty wide-reaching events. The security event log getting cleared, I want to know that that happened on domain controllers and domain computers, two well-known built-in groups in your Active Directory. So we don't need to create a special group for any of the things that are going on today. But let's say SQL Server type events, a critical SQL event, or maybe you just want to know, like you've got a custom application in your environment that logs event ID 777 and you need to know about that. Maybe create a couple of set groups of computers. Or Emmet, the Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit. Raise your hands if you know that. Okay. Emmet is exploit prevention. It's also something we give away for free. But it doesn't necessarily have its own centralized logging console, so WEF is a great augmentation to that because Emmet creates event IDs 1 and 2 when it stops something. So you could create a group of Emmet pilot computers and have only them send 1 and 2. The possibilities are endless. So we're going to pick domain computers and domain controllers. So adding domain computers here is what we're going to do. This is where you could do the certificate based for non-domain computers or other domains if you wanted to. So this is pretty cut and dry, domain computers. And then we're going to add domain controllers. They do not overlap. Thank you, guy in the front row who works with me. So domain controllers and domain computers are two groups in Active Directory which do not overlap. Domain controllers are all of the domain controller objects. It's auto-updating. It knows about it. Domain computers is everything that is a computer-type object in your environment that isn't a domain controller. So this actually allows you to have some pretty targeted event logging because local group changes, we probably don't care about those so much on a domain controller. And why don't we care about those on a domain controller, guy who knows this answer? That's correct. The local SAM database on a domain controller only contains the directory services restore mode password, right? So there is a local SAM database on your domain controllers, but like the local administrators group, built-in administrators group on a domain controller is actually the built-in administrators group in the domain. So when we're thinking about what we're looking for, we will want to switch those targeting. All right, so events to collect. I know, this is very, very stressful. How do we do this? This is cool, because you have three options here. You can take the GUI sitting in front of you, this lovely little GUI, and you can actually do some pretty cool stuff without actually having to know any special magic mojo. Because what we can see here is we can see what type of event, when it was logged, whether it was critical, which log it was in, or which event ID to collect. So for security log, event ID 1102, which indicates the security log was cleared, I never have to leave the GUI. That's pretty cool, because that means that you don't have to be elite scripter, you don't have to be a custom guy. This is something that you can go home and do, very scalable. So we're going to do just that. We're going to pick which event log, and we're going to pick the security log. This applications and services logs things, have you guys ever gone digging down there? Crazy cool stuff down there. There's actually logs for group policy processing or the print operational, so you can know every single document that was printed off of computer. Lots of cool stuff down there. Okay, so Windows logs, we're gonna go ahead and pick just the security log, and then we're gonna go to event IDs, and we are going to specifically pick which one? 1102, okay. So that is specifically what we're looking for here. And by the way, here is my cheat sheet, which you will all get at the end. All right. So if you wanted to, you could pick specific users or computers that this is targeted to. So this one's the easy mode one. This one was really quite easy. But if you click on the XML tab here, this is what's called an XPath filter. So XPath filters are not necessarily just for Windows event forwarding, but that's where I always use them. But you can also use them in SCOM. So if you learn this magic, you could use it into other technology as well. But this is where you could actually create some really, really custom crazy stuff looking for specific parts of an event ID. So this one's gonna be easy. We're just gonna do the easy mode one here. And we're gonna go ahead and hit advanced here because there's a couple different options on here. The one I like is minimize latency, because that means it's going to go ahead and send those events, and it's going to catch up on the events, and maybe that's not the one you want to use in your remote office that's got a 56K dial-up, but while we're testing, we want to make sure we get those. There's also a drop-down there for protocol, HTTP versus HTTPS. Now, I'm a security nerd, so I should be picking HTTPS, right? Not in this instance necessarily. I welcome you to go and configure HTTPS if you want, but because this is using Kerberos traffic, you're already doing a lot of the protections of the traffic there. You can't necessarily sniff this on the wire and decrypt it, and it should be doing authentication of the endpoints there. And actually, most of the time, if you tried to fall back to NTLM on Windows Remote Management for event forwarding, it just doesn't work at all. So, and you actually get a specific event ID for that. So if you have a PKI infrastructure, if you know what you're doing, if you want to go out there and you want to configure this on HTTPS, I welcome you to do so. That is a really, that'll help you make it more robust. But is it entirely necessary? Not necessarily for just getting it running in your environment. All right. So now we will wait 60 seconds. And why will we wait 60 seconds? Because we had refresh equals 60 in our actual URL for it to check into. So we have to wait for the computer to check into that URL, find out we created a new subscription, then apply it to that system. So there's a couple different ways to troubleshoot what might be happening here. So in this column here, we actually see that we have source computers. So we see zero computers care about the subscription yet. Oh, it just changed to one. Okay, so at that point in time, one computer has gone out to the URL, figured out that it should care about if a security event log gets cleared, and now if we do that, it'll show up in the forwarded events log. This isn't hard. I'm sorry if it's disappointing the people that are leaving. Okay. but yeah, so that's it. That's it's checked in. The one guy's checked in. We know who's in there. And now we can go out and we can start testing that. So I'm going to guess that the one that's checked in is actually this guy because it's him. So if we actually go into Applications and Services logs, we go into Microsoft, we go into Windows, and there's actually an event log forwarder plugin in here. So we can actually troubleshoot what's going on there. So we can see the forwarder successfully connected to Bob. So we actually already collected, we connected, we got our subscriptions. That's what's going on there. So that log for you there can help you troubleshoot whether or not you've connected to it. So we have, we're successful. Typical things that go wrong there, maybe you've got a duplicate service principal name. If you try to install Windows Event Forwarding on something that's already running an HTTP service principal name, it will fail. If Kerberos just isn't working in your environment, you'll see a failure. But the logging here is actually quite descriptive. So this one is actually, I had trouble communicating with it because it was offline at that time. So there's some pretty good logging in there for you. But we've checked in. We definitely are doing things as far as that goes. So let's see how many computers we have checked into the forwarded events. Okay, so I have two in there. So if I go in and I go to the security log of this computer, where I have lots of events, right? Let's see, let's clear that log. Let's be bad guys. All right, so we cleared that log. Let's give a couple seconds. You know, some demo gods might be against me, as we've seen tonight. If we go into forwarded events, we actually see some 111 events. So the 111 events are not bad. That means that something has checked into a Windows event forwarder. So the computers that I see in there, we definitely see Bob, and then we see our domain controller in there too. So Bob has connected, but he's not picked up the subscription yet. So that might be part of our problem there. So while we're waiting on Bob, let's build another one, right? Because sometimes this does take a little bit. This is actually the worst part of this, is that frequently when you set this up, you will just want to go and have lunch. It does take a minute to cook. Once it's cooked, once it's set up, we usually find that the events come in pretty quickly. But this is an exercise in patience at first, because it will take a little bit to come in. Okay, so let's set up another one. So creating a subscription, let's say local administrator group changes, right? So how hard would that one be? Well, conveniently enough, I've already prepared a OneNote where that's in there. It's called Logs for Ignite AU. So local administrator group changes, 4733, 4732. Those are the event IDs we're going to look for. And this is actually an XPath filter. So we can see that what we're looking for here is actually going to be very targeted. So we're going to look for the, we're going to go and we're going to query. We're going to look for a certain log. We're going to look for the security log. We're going to look for event IDs 4732 and 4733, right? That part's cut and dry. That part should make a lot of sense right there, right? But then we have to know a little bit about how the Windows event log works. Ever since Vista type ages, Windows 7, we've actually been using an XML format for the logs. So the logs have a lot of additional data inside of what's going on there. So if I look at a security log, and I look at a particular event ID, this is just a random event ID, we can see what's going on here. We can see, you know, an account was logged off. It looks like it was the computer account. But if we click on the details view, and more specifically the XML view on that log, we've got a lot of additional things we can query on in here. Because what we can see is actually different areas that we can look for. So target username, target domain name. Each one of those can be pulled out into an XPath filter. So if you have anything at all there that's very specific inside of that event ID, that's something you can query on. It's really cool. So for what we're actually looking for here is we're actually going to be looking for the event ID, the target username, and the name of administrators, the built-in administrators group on that machine, right? We're going to be looking by the event name. So if I take this, and I'm going to use some very magical tools called cut and paste, and I go back to my event log collector, and I go to create that subscription, and we'll call it local group changes, local admin changes. Is there a question? Okay. We'll make it source computer initiated again, and we're going to make this only domain computers. And we'll go to select events. We're going to click on the XML tab. Now, this is where we have to click edit query manually. And it gives you an alert. There's no turning back. That's what it's telling you. Once you create a subscription and you switch to editing the XML manually, if you want to go back to the GUI mode, you do have to recreate the whole subscription. So that's what that's warning you about there. But we're brave. We believe in ourselves. So we're going to click yes there. And whoops. And we are going to go ahead and we are going to paste in the XPath filter that we had there. I think it's so cute when it types it, right? But this is cool because this is readable. This is something that you could play around with, you could edit, you could create one from the GUI and start to change parameters in it. Open up your event ID that you're interested in collecting, because that's how I recommend you do this. Mimic the behavior that you're looking to monitor, take a look at that event ID, click on the XML tab, and figure which one you want to filter for. It's really quite easy once you get it to there. So click OK, hope it accepts my XML there. Minimize latency just like we did before, and now we have that there. So the log cleared subscription, I wonder who's checked in on that one. We're gonna try that on another workstation just in case we're having some problems there. So let's check and see if this workstation's checked in, which we would do through the event forwarding plugin. So someone in the audience might be sitting there thinking, I really don't want to sit there and cut and paste a bunch of stuff in or edit these all day. Does that sound like what you're thinking? You're thinking, this is great. It's great for one or two little things. But what if I want to do this kind of scalably throughout my environment and maybe import them all at once? The good news is that you can. The Windows event collector, the Windows event log, all of those services are all scripted. So you can actually do an import or export. You can use different things programmatically to get into there. So you don't actually have to do this all day long like this. But it is nice when you're first learning about it in order to get in there and figure out what's going on. Questions? So I'm going to clear the event log on a domain controller, which should be a bad thing. Okay. Right. right, here we go, event log, woohoo. So right now it's rendering as a SID, because like I told you, it takes a minute to cook. But we can see that we did actually get an event that somebody cleared that. So this is working, right? So you can go home, and you can collect event ID 1102 right now, because that one's one you definitely want to get, right? Okay. Questions? It shouldn't be, because it's really easy. All right, so who wants to see how to import them in a script? Who wants to know how to get those five top things that we care about instantly put into your environment? So these XML files, which I believe I will tweet with the hashtag of the session, and then I'll put them in a blog post so you'll be able to grab them, were written by Russell Tompkins in the front row, so round of applause. Okay. So these are actually logs that I asked for. These are the ones that I said, these are the top five things that I think are security important. Let's get them in, get them out there so you guys can go ahead and start to import them. So you gotta follow all that other stuff. You gotta get the collector ready. But then this XML file, we're gonna look for local admins changed, local user created or deleted, a new service installed, an event log cleared. So this is the one that you apply to domain computers, not to domain controllers. And then we're gonna have another one, which we will apply to the domain controllers, which is gonna be different events, because we're gonna be looking for some very specific things in there. So we are looking for a new service installed, because I wanna know about PS exec on there. For the domain computers one, you may wanna take out new service installed if you have an environment where software changes frequently, so feel free to edit the XML files. But I really would like you to watch for new service on a domain controller. So member added or removed from an administrative group. So the event IDs for domain-based global group has changed. And then we're gonna go ahead and we're gonna give it, this is actually looking for specific names in there. That's actually the query that it's looking for. It's looking for target username, and it's looking for domain admins, built-in administrators, and enterprise admins. That's not all of the privileged groups that you should be monitoring in your domain, but it's a great start if you're not already doing it. So that's gonna go ahead and do it for you. And it's going to look, last but not least, for if the security event log is cleared on the domain controller, because that might be important to look for. So how do we make this magic happen? Well, using these magical XML files that we have, we will be able to use these commands, wcutil, we're going to give it cs, and we're going to import that XML file. So that, if that's all you take away from this, is you cut and paste those XML files that I'm going to tweet out, and you run these two commands, and you only monitor those five things, you're already doing a lot of really good work. So I think that that's probably worth the 5-minute investment of time in your environment. So let's go ahead and do that. Let's go ahead and do that 5-minute investment. And this will already be scoped for those domain computer and domain controller groups, is actually how he's actually scoped these out for you there. Oh wait, I need to figure out who I am, who I'm logged in as. I'm logged in as Bob, okay. Okay, so since those XML files are my desktop, I'm gonna go ahead and paste the command in there so it'll run in the context of where it's locally put. Invalid config file. Russ, how dare you? Ah, it's domain computers, that's why. Russ, how dare you? Okay, so to be fair, this was written about 5 minutes before we came down because I thought it was really important to get it out to you guys. So this may not work immediately as I'm typing it in there into the tiny, tiny window, but we'll make sure it works before we get it out there. So you'll be able to, in the space of the 5 minutes it took us, configure a Windows event forwarding server to collect the events, run the script, import these, and be monitoring those five events. I think that's pretty cool, because even if you don't use the script for it, the XPath filter's right there. You can cut and paste it, and you could put it into that XML format, and you could build that right there. And now you know how to look for very targeted, very specific events, because all we need to do is bring up an event that we're interested in. Let's say we go to the security log, and I'm suddenly interested in those special logons that I talked about. Well, here's a special logon. So maybe I wanna be looking for a special logon for very important special types of people. And maybe I wanna change that attribute, and I want to be looking for, you know, a type of group as my special logon. Maybe the very particular people I'm looking for, does a domain admin log onto a workstation? Or does somebody in the group that's the SID S151 or S1515113, the local account group, right? If I'm looking for a local account has logged into a workstation, that would be something I could target and be interested in. So there's twofold to that. We've got to be able to look at the event ID and figure out what we're looking for in the XPath filter. But first off, we've got to configure that special logon event. Yeah, absolutely. The question was, is if somebody uses a run as command, will we pick it up? So run as actually does log on with explicit credentials, so you would actually have to look for a different event ID for it, which is actually in the list I gave to Russ. So the log on with explicit credentials is in that list there. So I'm going to put a cheat sheet of all the different event IDs and what they mean, but that NSA white paper that I sent you also details what they mean. But run as is a very important question, because not only is it explicit credentials, do you remember the logon types conversation we had this morning about which logons leave credentials in the LSAS process? So if I'm a domain admin and I've done the right thing, I've got my Bob account and I've got my Bob domain admin account. So I'm sitting there and I'm surfing the web and I'm reading my email and I'm doing all that as Bob. But I've got to hit Active Directory users and computers. Really critical domain admin thing I need to do. So I hold down the shift key on my keyboard, I right click on Active Directory users and computers, and I do a run as Bob the domain admin. What type of logon is that? That is an interactive logon. You are leaving credentials in the LSAS process. So all of that good behavior you just thought you did, all of that awesome that you think you're doing, bad guy comes through, mimicats, grabs your credentials, he's good to go. Keylogger, he's good to go, right? So, run as is interesting because it's not just a different logon type. It's not just explicit credentials. It actually is going to be storing your credentials in the LSAS process too. There are not flashy time things at this one. Okay. All right. So we're going to do one more thing, and then we're going to wrap it up here. So the thing that we're looking for here is we are actually looking for that special logon event. So in the audit settings GPO I created here, I created a group policy preference. And the registry key you're looking for is this one. Because this logon key, current control set, LSA audit, give it the special groups, and then stick the SIDs you want in there. Finding the domain admin's group SID is actually kind of difficult because you can't just go into attribute editor and find it. So go to a domain controller, log on as a domain admin, do whoami/groups, boom, you've got that SID. So paste in the SIDs you're interested in. If you create a group called don't log on to domain controllers, find the SID of that and pop that in there. And then when someone does log on, you'll have a very specific event ID that you can track. Double click on it, get the XPath filters, you'll see exactly what's going on there for those people. Great way to track lateral movement, even if you haven't put the protective controls in it. So Windows Event Forwarding, it's free, it's built in, it's not perfect, so we can extend it a little bit. This already works with your great SIM investments you might already have. So if you've got something in the environment, an ArcSight, a Splunk, or whatever, you can have them collect from your Windows Event Collector. So you've got that single pane of glass. You can use SCOM for alerting. So if I've got SCOM set up to do subscriptions with new acknowledged and closed states, you could have it pick up from here and use those states for your critical events. You could do it into Azure Operational Insights in the exact same way, or you could use Power BI, because that's really weird and you probably didn't think about it. So Power BI, I'm not going to tell you to use it for everything, but it's a great way that you can use kind of a big data viewpoint into what's in your logs if you're willing to send them to the cloud. Because what we have here is we've actually got a firewall log based on the IPsec filter driver logs in the Windows Event Log. So we can see which applications are doing what, which trends, and you can get those data slicers in the cloud. Able to see that, you can extend that with Power BI. And there's actually a link in the deck where you can go out and you can get this because it's open sourced. So hopefully this was useful to you today. Hopefully you will go home and you will actually start to monitor some of this very critical stuff that's out there. And you will be able to very quickly log for those five critical events in your environment, making it so that I don't have to wish for a time machine should you have an incident response. So thanks a lot, guys. Let me know if you have any questions. Hit me up with the addresses you see there, and good luck logging.